Dave, you're one of the most traveled of astronauts. You first flew in 1966 with Neil Armstrong and Gemini 8, and as our listeners may recall, that was sort of a hairy flight. You had an emergency and had to come back to Earth in a hurry. Then 3 years later, to the month, came Apollo 9 and the Earth-orbiting checkout mission of that lunar module, which is going to be your home now for several days. How do you feel with so much time under your belt and with all this experience going into one of the most dangerous areas of the moon?
Well, I feel pretty lucky, Rhett. I think it's a great opportunity to culminate all the things that I've had a chance to do in the past into one good mission to a very interesting place on the moon.
Let's bring our listeners up today just a little bit on the commander of Apollo 15. Dave Scott, you were a West Point graduate, right?
Right.
The United States Military Academy. And tell us a little about your flying career and your educational background and where you came from originally.
Well, I was born in San Antonio, Texas. And after graduating from the military academy, I went to flying school and was subsequently stationed in the Netherlands as a fighter pilot for the U.S. Air Force and a squadron assigned to the Dutch Air Force under the NATO agreement. And I spent four delightful years flying F-100s there. At the conclusion of that tour, I went back to school to MIT to get a graduate degree with the hopes I'd be able to go on to the test pilot school at Edwards Air Force Base, and which I did. And at the conclusion of the test pilot school, I had the opportunity to go to their space school there. And that finally led into a chance to apply for the NASA program, which I did, and here I am.
Well, you made a very good record at West Point. You were known as a darn good pilot. All of these things led to an outstanding career, which I'm sure were taken into account when you were selected to be an astronaut.
Thank you, Rhett.
What's the most challenging thing to you, off the top of your head, about the mission? I've heard you say in the past the whole mission is a challenge, but can you just pinpoint one overall feel about Apollo 15 for me?
Well, I think naturally the landing is the most challenging because that requires the most attention, the most concentration, and it's most demanding on man and machine. And I think when you get in a situation in which everybody is being challenged to the utmost of their capability, that is indeed the most interesting part of any mission.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much, Dave Scott. We'll be listening to you throughout the mission. Dave, Apollo 15 is going into what may well be the most unusual and difficult landing site of all the Apollo missions. You're coming in over a horseshoe of mountains some 9,800 meters tall. You're landing down in this crescent or horseshoe configuration, and you must touch down within 2 kilometers of a deep canyon. Now, I'm sure everybody all over the world wonders how in the world you're going to do it. Isn't this extremely dangerous?
Well, I think had we not gone to the moon 3 times before, it would be extremely dangerous. But we've learned a lot of things from Apollo 11, 12, and 14 about landing. And we have a great deal of confidence now that the predictions and the targeting are quite adequate to put us in a pinpoint landing situation. And our maximum dispersions, or the greatest area in which we might find ourselves at Hadley, is about 1 kilometer radius. So within this 1 kilometer radius circle, we'll hopefully find ourselves in the very center of it, but at any rate, anywhere in that circle, we have an acceptable landing site.
Mm-hmm.
And we have the capability on board to change the trajectory after about 7,000 feet and select any other landing site within the vicinity of the basin there, the plain where we land.
How close are you coming to the mountaintops as you come down across?
Oh, we're about 7,000 feet above them, so we're...
Mm-hmm. Let me put that in meters. That's over 2,000 meters.
About 2,000 meters, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then, the reason you have the confidence is because of this refined trajectory experience which the men in mission control and all of you astronauts have in flying previous lunar modules, right?
That's correct.
And there really is no worry about being able to pinpoint a landing site anymore among all of you, is there?
Well, that's true. We have to pay attention to what we're doing, but I think the difference is we now know what we're doing. If we're off, we know we're off. In the beginning, it was the old adage, we didn't know what we didn't know. Mm-hmm. And now when we get into a situation, we know what we don't know, and we can make the proper corrections.
The mission control, the flight operations team, say that they have every confidence they can bring you down to what is called high gate with complete accuracy, and you have all of your redundant systems, your safety measures for abort to get back out of there should you get into trouble. And then once you pitch over and you can see the landing site, then it's your ball game, and you're right where all the other pilots are. Is that the general feel?
That's the general feeling, yes.
Mm-hmm. All right, tell us what you see there when you pitch over and look down there after high gate, as it's called.
Well, our primary cue, and that's at about 2,000 meters in altitude, we look for the Rill, because it's such a positive landmark.
The Rill, the deep canyon.
The deep canyon. It's a very definite feature. And from that point, once we've located ourselves relative to the Rill, we move back to the east to a crater called Index Crater, which mm-hmm. is what we call it because it's our index.
I'm going to be describing that in great length.
Well, it's interesting also that it's the crater that Al Warden will use for his landmark tracking in order to tie the landing site to the Command and Service Module orbit before we go down, which is necessary to get our relative positions. So we all use the same crater, and we use that as our landmark relative to the landing. Once we find Index Crater, then it's a matter of moving visually several hundred meters to the northwest to find the precise landing site.
Mm-hmm. And from that point on to touchdown, how do you plan to pilot the machine?
Well, we plan to let the vehicle fly on the automatic trajectory with the computer controlling it, down to about 400 feet, unless we see some
dispersion. That's a little over 120, 30 meters, somewhere
right
along there.
And then at that point, I'll take over manually and finish the landing, flying the vehicle manually in order to select a smooth, level spot in which to place it.
I flew one of these landings in the simulator the other day, and I came down a little too hard and rolled over in the simulator. How many times do you practice this in the simulator mechanisms here and at the Cape?
Oh, hundreds. Right? I wouldn't even want to count the numbers of times.
Does the real thing sometimes then seem an old hat to you by the time you get to it?
Well, I've never been to the real thing yet, so I'll tell you when we get back.
Uh-huh. Well, you simulated docking in Gemini. You simulated your docking in LEM in Apollo 9.
I see what you're alluding to. I think one of the real things we've learned in this program, which I think is tremendous, is that we can simulate the actual world here on the Earth. And we've learned that we can save many, many dollars and many, many flights by practicing everything before we go. And then it becomes, shall we say, old hat. We practiced the dockings, and when I flew in Apollo 9 and did the first docking with a Command Service Module to the LEM, it was very similar to the simulations, and I felt I knew what I could expect. And this builds my confidence in the simulations. So through our background and our experience, we know that simulations prepares you quite adequately for the real thing. Mm-hmm. And with that, we get our confidence.
Thanks very much, Apollo 15 Commander David Scott. Dave, from our conversations earlier and from listening to you discuss these lunar traverses, the lunar exploration for Apollo 15, you've really been turned on and excited about it. I think you're going to be on the threshold of some of the greatest scientific discoveries in the history of mankind, and I get the sense that you feel that way too.
Oh, absolutely.
Let's talk about them just a bit. During the first traverse, what are you going to do, and what do you think is going to be the important thing to find?
Well, I'll briefly summarize, because I could spend a great deal of time on this
subject the rest of the day while you're doing it. Yeah.
But primarily, we expect to look at the material from the Apennine front on the first traverse. And hopefully this will give us an answer as to whether there was an original crustal material on the moon before the many impacts which created its face, or the surface is basically layer upon layer upon layer of debris from impacts as far back as the creation of the moon.
Now, the Apennine front, this is where the mountains fall off and some debris has fallen down into this mare site where you're landing. You can't drive your rover all the way up the side of it, but supposedly you can get to this debris area and get a very good sampling of it.
Yes,
right?
The crater called St. George, we feel, has excavated deep enough to bring up this original crystalline material, which if the crustal material existed, it's crystalline.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something that we expect to find on the that's similar to an orthosite. And
an orthosite. You know, you're a geologist.
Well, yes, we're. I hope we're geologists. And if we find a crystalline material there, it answers one question. If we find nothing but the breccias, which are the layering of many, many events, we have another answer to the question.
Mm-hmm. And then you do plan to take a look at the rill on that first traverse as you
yes,
go out
right.
down south in the rover?
Yes, we have a place on the, we call it the elbow, at which we can see the bottom of the rill in two directions, which precludes the necessity of going over the edge of the rill.
Mm-hmm.
We can see it from the corner there, from the elbow.
Mm-hmm.
And,
we'll be hearing you talk about elbow. We're at elbow,
right.
We're at the front. Give me some of the names we'll be hearing you call out during that first traverse.
We'll see Elbow Crater, and we'll see St. George Crater, and there are three smaller ones there in the area between Station 2 and 3.
We'll hear you talking about stations, sites you're supposed to go
to. Not so much stations this time, Rhett, as areas.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the resolution of the photography and the lack of knowledge of what's really there, why our stations are within an area there that we almost sometimes call a boutonnage, which is a geological term for a long, thin formation in a rock. But
mm-hmm.
We go to an area, and someplace in the area we hope to find a significant crater to help us understand mm-hmm. what's there. And somewhere between 2 and 3 we'll run across, we hope, flow. And we've named these craters based on what they associate geologically. Mm-hmm. We have a crater called Flow, one called Slide, and one called Fan.
Mm-hmm.
And we should go by all of those.
All right, we'll be listening to you and Jim Irwin describe them and talk about them when you get there. Now, on the second traverse, and again, the most important part of this whole mission is lunar exploration, even more so than the experiments package, right?
Right.
All right, the second traverse, you're going to go as far as 7.5 kilometers away.
Right.
That in itself could be sort of dangerous, but you have redundant systems to help you get back safely, don't you? The rover,
yes.
Your backpacks, the buddy system, and so forth.
Yes, we always have the capability to walk back. We have enough time and enough consumables with us in our backpacks to walk back from any point at any time.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the constraint on distance.
How far away will you be able to see the limb as you depart? Just a couple of kilometers?
Yes. On the lunar surface, if it were a smooth billiard ball type surface, a man 6 feet tall can see 2.5 kilometers mm-hmm. to the horizon.
In this case, it isn't smooth. You have all sorts of rises and falls, so you may not average that.
That's right.
Okay. The same thing goes for the second traverse, examining the front, the Apennine front, right?
Yes. The Apennine front is a series of different formations. The base of the front there is comprised of first the crater St. George, and then what we expect is a landslide down the side. And then as we go along, we find other material which has not been slumped from the upslopes. There's probably less mass wasting. And we find at the end of the area there on Station 2, or on EVA 2, a crater called Front Crater, which has apparently excavated a contact between the front and the Maury surface, because there's an inflection point or a change in slope right in the middle of the crater.
We're going to have some geologists talking at length about that here with us. So
good.
But that is a prime objective to get to if you can possibly...
Yes, that's correct.
If everything goes well off that 7.5 kilometers away.
Depending on how the traffic ability is in that area.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, can we drive the rover through the debris if there is debris there?
Mm-hmm. Then on the third EVA, you go up to the side of the rill, and then you go to some interesting secondary craters up to the north.
Well, yes. The north complex there on the third EVA, I think, is one of the most exciting areas at Hadley. We think it's a volcanic constructional complex, we being the crew, I guess, and some people don't share our thoughts on it, and there's a little controversy as to how that was actually formed. And we hope to bring back the samples to show exactly what caused the northern complex. But it's a very interesting and unique feature in the Hadley area.
Thanks very much, Apollo Commander David Scott. Dave, as I think I've mentioned on the air before, you impress me with a particularly keen sense of history on what's being accomplished in the Apollo program, and you certainly are aware of the possible scientific benefits and discoveries to be made on your flight. Let's talk about that and how you feel about this whole moon exploration program.
Well, I think the only reason we have the capability to go and explore the moon is because many years ago, people had the same idea, and explorers set forth to seek scientific knowledge outside of their own environment.
You certainly have named your spacecraft after one of those, Captain
yes.
Cook's Endeavour.
We found that James Cook, a little over 200 years ago, set out on the first purely scientific expedition by ship primarily to Tahiti to witness the to observe the transit of the planet Venus, and to subsequently explore the South Pacific. And he was on a purely scientific voyage for the first time, and our command and service module is going on a purely scientific voyage for the first time, carrying the bay of scientific instruments. And so we felt there was a certain relationship there, and therefore we chose the name that Captain Cook chose, the Endeavour.
Well, how do you feel about the overall impact of the Apollo discoveries? You think it's really going to take years and years for mankind to really absorb the significance of what you're doing right now?
Well, it'll take years and years to reduce all the data, and that's for sure, because of the magnitude of data recorded on this flight, and to understand it. And the samples brought back, many of them will not be investigated for years. They put them away for a decade to let the next decade of scientists look at something fresh and new. And we feel that understanding the moon is much like understanding Australia in the days of James Cook. It was unknown. There were many very significant and wonderful things there. And I'm sure that in the years to come, the scientific community, having the opportunity to analyze the data we gather around and on the surface of the moon, will come to some very profound conclusions about the formation of the moon, the Earth, and the solar system.
That's something in which you take pride as you're doing this, isn't it?
Oh, certainly. I think that in order to propagate mankind and enable man to continue on his growth and his development on the Earth and maintain his livability on the Earth, he has to explore and he has to reach out. And we're reaching now to a realm which was unheard of 200 or 300 years ago.
Thanks very much, Dave Scott, and we'll be listening and following very carefully everything you're doing there on the surface of the moon during Apollo 15.
Thank you, Ed.
David Scott, commander of Apollo 15.